weekend.
Today is Friday, January 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. A Pakistani court has ordered the release of a man who killed a U.S. journalist.
A decision that lawyers representing Pearl's family branded a travesty of justice that has left his loved ones in complete shock.
Plus, Britain and the European Union clash over coronavirus vaccine distribution and returning a leopard into the wild.
It is incredibly beautiful. She has these huge, piercing eyes.
We'll have these stories and more next. Pakistan's Supreme Court on Thursday ordered the release of an Islamist convicted of beheading American journalist Daniel Pearl of the Wall Street Journal. Reuters' Lauren Anthony is up first.
The country's Supreme Court on Thursday ordered the release of Ahmed Omar Saeed Sheikh, a decision that lawyers representing Pearl's family branded a travesty of justice that has left his loved ones in complete shock. Ahmed Omar Saeed Sheikh was the main suspect in the 2002 kidnapping and killing of Pearl, who was abducted in Karachi while investigating militants in the days after the 9/11 attacks on the United States. Video of Pearl's beheading that emerged at the time grabbed international headlines. Sheikh was released by a panel of three judges by a majority vote of 2-1, a provincial advocate general told Reuters. It was not immediately clear whether acquittal meant a finding of not guilty or if Sheikh had merely finished his jail terms. He had served 18 years in prison. A high court last year commuted the death penalty of British-born Sheikh into a life sentence and acquitted his three co-accused, citing a lack of evidence. According to the head of the court panel, Sheikh and three co-accused are to be released if they are not required in any other cases. The process can take several days. The government and Pearl's parents have challenged the court decision and asked the Supreme Court to reinstate the death penalty. Pleas it turned down on Thursday. The United States had said that it may seek to retry Sheikh if efforts to keep him in prison failed.
Lauren Anthony reports for Reuters News. A World Health Organization team emerged from quarantine in the Chinese city of Wuhan Thursday to start fieldwork on a fact-finding mission into the origins of the coronavirus pandemic. The mission has become politically charged as China seeks to avoid blame for alleged missteps in its early response to the outbreak. A major question is where the Chinese side will allow the researchers to go and whom they will be able to talk to. In other COVID-related news, a vaccine war has erupted between Britain and the European Union, with Brussels demanding that tens of millions of COVID-19 vaccine doses earmarked for Britain and made by a British pharmaceutical company be diverted to Europe to make up for a shortfall in promised deliveries. The demand marks a sharp political turn in the dispute between the EU and the drug company AstraZeneca, as well as underscoring the mounting risks of vaccine nationalism. The reduction will add woes to an EU inoculation program that has gotten off to a sluggish and, at times, chaotic start. So far, only two doses have been administered for every 100 Europeans, compared to 7 in the United States and 11 in Britain. For the first time, a new coronavirus variant, first seen in South Africa, has been found in the United States. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani has more.
There are now two apparently unconnected cases in South Carolina in two adults with no recent travel history. While viruses constantly mutate, scientists are mainly worried right now about three variants that may spread more easily. The one from South Africa, plus others first reported in the United Kingdom and Brazil that have already been found in the U.S. Dr. Anthony Fauci said yesterday it appears the existing COVID-19 vaccines are not as effective against the South African variant, but
it still is well within the cushion of protection.
And the government will work with vaccine makers on what Fauci calls boosts to address the variants. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Poland's government put into effect on Wednesday a constitutional court decision banning terminations of pregnancies with fetal defects as conservative policies increasingly take root in one of Europe's most devoutly Catholic countries. Reuters' Soraya Ali has those details.
Poland was rocked by mass protests last October when a constitutional court decided in favor of the ban, forcing the conservative government to delay its implementation until now. Protesters gathered again after the news was announced late on Wednesday, and abortion activists say more will follow. The new law only allows abortions in cases of rape and incest and when the mother's life or health is endangered. Access to abortion has declined even without the legislative curbs, as more doctors refuse to perform them on religious grounds and many women seek abortions abroad. One Law and Justice politician said the party would consider introducing new rules that could allow the most extreme fetal deformities to be excluded. But political commentators say an agreement between the party and its arch-conservative governing allies would be difficult to achieve.
Saroya Ali reports for Reuters News. The UN Refugee Agency is appealing for $100 million to provide protection and support for thousands of African refugees risking their lives trying to reach and cross the Mediterranean Sea. Lisa Schlein reports.
Escalating conflicts and violence in Africa's Sahel region and new displacement in the eastern Horn of Africa are causing increasing numbers of people to flee across the Sahara Desert. Many subsequently embark on dangerous sea journeys across the Mediterranean to Italy in search of asylum. The UN Refugee Agency reports at least 1,064 people died or disappeared in the central and western Mediterranean Sea in 2020. The agency has verified the deaths of about 1,800 people on the land journey across the Sahara. It says that's just the tip of the iceberg, as it is not possible to collect data on the missing. Vincent Costel, the UNHCR special envoy for the Central Mediterranean situation, says refugees and migrants recount harrowing tales of brutality and abuse along their journeys. The main risk people face, he says, is that of extortion from smugglers who very quickly become traffickers.
We heard from many women that they have experienced rape several times along the route. So risk of extortion, risk of labor exploitation, sexual exploitation, rape, and just murder. Some people are just abandoned in the desert in total neglect without food and water.
The UNHCR's $100 million strategic action plan and appeal covers 25 countries that are related to the movements of refugees and migrants. Costel says the aim is to assist the refugees along their way. It also seeks to lessen their need to embark on dangerous journeys on land and sea.
We may not be able to stop dangerous journey, but we do not believe in their inevitability. It is almost too late for us to intervene when people arrive in Libya or in the Western Sahara. Investment in better services and in protection must take place along the route and not only in coastal states.
Costel says money will be used to help refugees access education and livelihoods in countries of asylum. Priority will be given to provide protection for refugees in remote locations and to give cash assistance to vulnerable refugees in urban settings. The UNHCR is appealing to countries to strengthen safe and legal pathways for refugees, including through family reunification, which is a right under international law. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Video of a woman playing her piano as police raid her home in Russia has become one of the latest scenes of authorities in that nation cracking down on supporters of Alexei Navalny, the prominent critic of President Vladimir Putin. Reuters reporter Matthew Laratonda has the details.
Anastasia Vasilyeva is an ally of Alexei Navalny, the prominent Russian opposition politician currently in prison. She's his personal medic. She's playing the piano while the police raid her home. Scenes like these in the last few days have played out across Russia as authorities have raided the homes and offices of those close to the critic of President Vladimir Putin. And on Thursday, a court ordered that Navalny remain behind bars, rejecting the appeal against his detention. More mass protests by his supporters may hit this weekend, demanding his release. Truth is on our side, he's telling the court via video link. We are the majority, and we won't allow a bunch of villains to impose their rules on our country. Polls suggest Putin dwarfs Navalny in popularity. Navalny was originally arrested on alleged parole violations when he returned to Russia after recovering from the poisoning attempt on his life, and has faced many legal cases against him, including embezzlement, which he says are trumped-up charges to silence him. His allies that were raided have been accused of encouraging illegal protests, encouraging minors to participate in those protests, and breaking coronavirus restrictions. Tens of thousands of people turned out to those protests across the country, and almost 4,000 of them were detained in Moscow alone. Navalny could face years in prison.
That was Reuters' Matthew LaRotonda. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. While much of the world welcomes the election of Joe Biden as U.S. president, some in Israel are nervous that he will change U.S. Middle East policy. Linda Gradstein has that story.
Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza welcome the election of President Joe Biden, hoping for a change from former President Trump's Middle East policies.
The Palestinians' first priority right now is to get the so-called peace process back on track. They want the Biden administration to revive the two-state solution, which they believe was totally destroyed by the Trump administration. They want to resume contacts with the U.S. administration. The Palestinians have been boycotting the U.S. administration since December 2017, when Trump recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital.
The new Biden administration says that its commitment to Israel's security is sacrosanct, according to Secretary of State Anthony Blinken.
The best way, and maybe the only way, to ensure Israel's future as a Jewish democratic state and to give the Palestinians the state to which they are entitled is through the so-called two-state solution.
The Israeli government of Benjamin Netanyahu identified closely with Trump, and some say Israel will have to work hard to regain democratic support.
We should not have risked number one asset for us in America, which is bipartisan support. This has been damaged, and if I can look at the major negative of the for Israel when Trump was the president, this is this one.
Most Israeli analysts say the Middle East will be far down on Biden's list of priorities after more pressing domestic issues. When he does turn to the Middle East, he will likely focus on Iran. Israel has sharply opposed the 2015 Iran nuclear deal by world powers, saying it gives Iran a legal path to acquire nuclear weapons.
Iran will top the Middle Eastern agenda. Because it is the most prickly and urgent issue in the region, not only in terms of Iran's nuclear designs, which are obviously a global problem, but also in terms of Iran's Middle Eastern meddling. There isn't a civil war in the Middle East in which Iran isn't one way or another involved, and in a way that most of the world perceives as extremely destabilizing.
Most Israeli officials acknowledge that Biden has long been a supporter of Israel, but he also supports a Palestinian state and may try to pressure Israel to return to peace talks. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
When U.S. President Joe Biden last week lifted the controversial Trump-era travel ban on 13 countries, it came as a jolt of hope to many, but experts say it will take time to unravel the regulations grounding so many travelers. And locals in Nigeria, Libya, and Sudan, three of the impacted countries, say resolving the damage caused by the ban may take even longer. VOA's Heather Murdoch takes it from here.
The coffee shop on this street in Tripoli, Libya, is closed because of the coronavirus pandemic. So Mohammed Abdul Wahab, 37, gets his to go and drinks it in the parking lot. When the U.S. travel ban originally was declared in 2017 by former President Donald Trump, it was quickly dubbed the Muslim ban because it originally applied to Muslim-majority countries, including Libya, and came after Trump promised to close borders to Muslims. When asked how the ban affected his life, Abdul Wahab is thoughtful and a bit sad. He says he had wanted to go to graduate school in the U.S., but with the ban, he had no choice but to let go of that dream. Thousands of kilometers south, in Abuja, Nigeria, Wole Oleoye, a leading local journalist, is less sanguine. His son had already been accepted to a graduate program in California for artificial intelligence when Nigeria was added to the ban in early 2020. He never went.
I think that America should make up its mind whether it wants foreign students or not. You cannot allow your universities to go through the motions of requesting transcripts from universities, processing application for students, taking initial deposit, only for you to say the student cannot go.
About 4,000 kilometers west in eastern Sudan, the lifting of the travel ban is cause for celebration in a country that has long suffered from international isolation. For decades, Sudan has not just been on the U.S. travel ban list, but on a list of states the U.S. said sponsored terrorism. In December, Sudan was also removed from the terror list.
For me, the issue is different. I can see as a long-term impact, by the way.
In a noisy cafe in Gedaref, Mohammed Ahmed, a 38-year-old civil servant, acknowledges it will take a long time, but said the moves could increase investment, development, and general prosperity in Sudan. Sarah Pierce, a policy analyst at the Washington-based Migration Policy Institute, says lifting the travel ban could also change the U.S. for the better.
Immigration is one of the greatest resources for the United States. It's the resource that this nation was built on. So the idea that we are just indiscriminately blocking certain populations is a huge loss to the United States. It's a loss of family reunification. It's a loss of potential workers and a lot of other intangible things that we can't quite measure.
Pierce says it will also take time for the U.S. to revisit denied visa applications and review new ones before eligible travelers are back on the road. Back in Nigeria, journalist Oleoye says it will also take time for the U.S. to recover its reputation among potential travelers who viewed the ban as anti-Muslim or racist. But he says by the time the pandemic subsides and the world is considered generally safe for travel again, he assumes that at least in Nigeria, the U.S. once again will become a darling for travelers. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Istanbul.
This week, the Biden administration suspended sanctions on Yemen's Houthis. That's the rebel group that's backed by Iran, and the suspension lasts until February 26. It's a move that is not only welcomed by the United Nations, but by several aid agencies as well. Analysts differ on the next steps that they think Washington should take to resolve this six-year-old conflict in the Arab world's poorest nation, now in the grips of the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Dale Gavlak reports.
Washington is reviewing the decision taken in the waning days of former President Donald Trump's tenure to designate the Houthis as a foreign terrorist organization. The United Nations and 22 aid agencies working in Yemen fear the designation could trigger a large-scale famine by choking off badly needed food and medical imports and exacerbating its already dire humanitarian crisis. 90% of Yemen's staples are imported. The UN says most of Yemen's 30 million people need some form of aid or protection, with more than 13 million Yemenis facing acute food insecurity. UN officials have expressed concern the designation could impact peace talks to end the conflict involving Gulf power brokers Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. Helen Lackner, a Yemen researcher currently at the University of London's SOAS Middle East Institute, hopes the U.S. will press for a new UN Security Council resolution for Yemen to replace 2216. That resolution, passed in April 2015, essentially calls for the Houthis to surrender first and then for peace talks to begin.
The Biden administration could start on a new footing by sponsoring a resolution which would make negotiations possible. Negotiations on 2216 are not possible. 2216 is basically saying to the Houthis, withdraw, accept complete defeat, and go back to where you were in 2014. Why on earth should they do that and all the gains they've made in the last 6 years? I don't think I'm a supporter of the Houthis. To have a new resolution that is focused on the reality of the balance of power in Yemen, which maybe addresses the concerns of the Saudis, these things could be a big step forward towards a solution of the Yemen situation.
Analyst Hamdan Al-Shahri believes the Houthis were likely behind the recent air attacks on the Saudi capital, Riyadh. Everyone knows that the Houthis, backed by Iran, are the ones who carry out such terrorist acts and use ballistic missiles and drones, he told the Saudi Arab News Daily. They also tried to get on the new U.S. administration's good side by denying what happened in the kingdom, but everyone knows who is responsible for these actions. The article, Are Yemen's Iran-backed Houthis firing warning shots across Biden administration's bows, alleges the strikes may not be routine tactical operations in a low-intensity conflict, but rather reflective of a larger strategic decision by Iran to put President Joe Biden's foreign policy team on notice. The Houthis, a Zaydi Shiite movement, have been fighting Yemen's Sunni Muslim majority government since 2004. They took control of the capital, Sana'a, in September 2014 and continued on towards Aden, Yemen's largest city. They represent a third of the population and say they are fighting a corrupt system. In response to Houthi advances, Saudi Arabia and other Arab states launched a military campaign in March 2015, which continues until today. The group controls the capital and the north, where the majority of the population lives, forcing international aid groups to work with them to deliver aid. More than 112,000 Yemenis have been killed in the conflict, which has destroyed hospitals and other key infrastructure. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
And finally, after 3 years of bureaucratic wrangling, a healthy female leopard has finally been flown from South Africa to Mozambique's Gorongosa National Park. She made the three-hour flight in a custom wooden crate and was set free into the heart of a 4,000-square-kilometer park. Wildlife specialists hope she'll be able to produce enough cubs with Gorongosa's one male leopard to begin to restore Gorongosa's once-teeming carnivore population, which was decimated during the Mozambique 15-year Civil War. Now, to find out more about the leopard's arrival and what it means to the complex ecosystem, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Paula Boulay, Gorongosa's assistant director of conservation and the head of its large carnivore restoration project.
A leopard is actually one of the most widespread cats on Earth. In Africa, it is our only spotted large cat. They are a solitary cat, primarily nocturnal, and they tend to be unseen. But they're very much there. They're increasingly threatened and even facing endangerment because of loss of habitat and the impacts of hunting, both legal and illegal hunting.
Are leopards dangerous to people?
Well, they're not dangerous to people at all. They usually take small-bodied mammals, so like your impala and bushbuck and other small mammals that they've evolved over hundreds of thousands of years to hunt as part of these ecosystems.
It was quite some achievement to get her to you from South Africa, wasn't it?
Yeah, because it was such a difficult process for us. During one of the worst years most of us have experienced in a long time during this COVID-19 year, we managed to find a break in the permitting process. And before we knew it, we were flying one of the most beautiful animals I've ever seen across two international borders and giving her a safe home. And she's going to be the first of, we hope, many more to come, including hopefully the first cubs to be born in Gorongosa National Park in a very long time. So we're closely monitoring that.
When she finally arrived in this huge crate from South Africa, what was your first experience of her?
When she landed in this crate and we were just moments away from releasing her, there were these peepholes in the top of the crate where I could actually see her and like look her in the eye. And at one point she locked eyes with me and just let out this roar. which froze me to death. I mean, it was awe-inspiring. I felt it in my hands. I was actually holding the lid of the crate down.
Tell us more about what she looks like.
She's incredibly beautiful. She has these huge piercing eyes, long whiskers, and this beautiful colored spotted coat.
What color is her coat?
It's like an orange, gold, white, black coloration. So leopardy.
It sounds like you've already developed a bond.
You know, for one thing, I have an immense respect for her. She's made a long, long journey, and she's really sort of the frontier of this incredible recovery effort that's underway to really make a positive difference in terms of protecting biodiversity and turning the tide against extinction.
How confident are you that she will bear more leopard cubs to help repopulate the park?
In a sense, it is experimental. We did release her within range of a male that we've been tracking for a couple of years, so I don't think she'll have any problem pairing up with the male when they meet. But to really jumpstart a population, you need numbers, you need momentum. And so at this stage, she's really opened that door for us to show that we have the right kind of space for these animals to thrive. And so she needs to be the first of many more that we fly over to really get this population going.
I know you're counting on these leopards to prey on the baboons in Gongosa.
Absolutely. That's one of the ecological functions. They don't primarily prey on baboons, but they are the primary predator of baboons. And Gorongosa is notorious for its very large and widespread baboon troops. I mean, we have more than 200 troops in the park, and so that's thousands of baboons. And they've grown a bit lazy. Around dusk, you know, they'll hang out on the ground and they don't go up into the trees so quickly. And that is a sign to us of a missing element. In this case, it would be predation by a leopard. So I think they're going to be changing their behavior pretty soon now that she's around town.
Paola Boulay is the Assistant Director of Conservation at Gorongosa National Park. She's speaking to my colleague, Adam Phillips. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a fantastic Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Tens of thousands of Russian citizens in more than 120 cities and towns from St. Petersburg and Moscow in the west to Irkutsk and Yuzhno-Sakhalinsk in the east turned out on the weekend of January 23rd to peacefully protest the arrest of opposition leader Alexei Navalny and to demand his release. Navalny, a lawyer and anti-corruption activist, was detained on January 17th. He was arrested at Moscow's Sheremetyevo Airport upon his return to Russia from Germany, where he was recovering from an attempt to assassinate him by a nerve agent. The arrest, which was streamed live in Russia by independent journalists, resulted in the biggest unauthorized protests of Russian President Vladimir Putin's tenure. The U.S. supports the right of all people to peaceful protest, freedom of expression, tweeted Rebecca Ross, spokesperson for the U.S. Embassy in Moscow. Steps being taken by Russian authorities are suppressing those rights. Police response was at first relatively muted, but as the crowds of protesters grew and refused to disperse, the heavily armored riot police began to randomly pull people out of the crowd, arrest them, and drag them off. Across the country, well over 3,700 people were detained. Continued efforts to suppress Russians' right to peaceful assembly and freedom of expression, the arrest of opposition figure Alexei Navalny, and the crackdown on protests that followed are troubling indications of further restrictions on civil society and fundamental freedoms, said U.S. State Department spokesperson Ned Price. Russians' rights to peaceful assembly and to participate in free and fair elections are enshrined not only in the country's constitution, but also in Russia's OSCE commitments, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and in its international obligations under the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. The United States calls on Russian authorities to release all those detained for exercising their universal rights and for the immediate and unconditional release of Alexei Navalny. We urge Russia to fully cooperate with the international community's investigation into the poisoning of Alexei Navalny and credibly explain the use of a chemical weapon on its soil, said spokesperson Price. The United States will stand shoulder to shoulder with our allies and partners in defense of human rights, whether in Russia or wherever they come under threat.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.